It is Saturday, October 7, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Week in Geek news segment, followed by a discussion with John Derbyshire about algebra. It will be fascinating, interesting, and enlightening.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Geek Speak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Today on our show, we are talking with a professional mathematician and linguist, John Derbyshire, about algebra, actually, and the history of algebra. It will be amazing and interesting, but first, we're going to do geek news in our geek Week in Geek segment. During the second half of the show, during the entire show today, you're welcome to call us with pledges of support to KOSP, and we'll get into that more a little bit later. But right now, I want to introduce you to the geeks today. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me, I have Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance, Miles Elam, technical trainer at Circ Control, and in just moments from now, we'll also have Dee Dee Hubbard. So, welcome to Geek Speak, geeks.
Good morning.
Howdy, Lyle. Happy anniversary. Yeah, it's 5 years since we invaded Afghanistan.
Thank you so much.
I just heard that on the way over here.
Okay. Couldn't help but cheer.
No, I mean, come on. I wish we could figure out a geeky way to...
Although, in terms of anniversaries, this is around my sixth anniversary with the show.
I think so, yeah. It's about 6 years since we've been doing it. All right, Miles, let's start with you for the news. What's the one you want to hit off with at the top?
Well, one that you brought up to me yourself, one about target accessibility. You know, what does that mean? Target, the company, also affectionately known as Target, was recently sued due to accessibility issues with their website. In other words, a suit was filed by literally the plaintiff was all blind U.S. citizens.
It's like, you know, it's the kind of case you don't want to be on the opposite side of. You don't want to be fighting a case with 100 blind citizens. Because you just don't sound.
There's no way to win that.
Obviously, there's a fair amount of hyperbole in plaintiff name. But
what's the case here? I mean, we've been web developers for years. That's how we met. We were doing websites for radio stations in Los Angeles. And there's always been this concept of accessibility. And it's been this kind of strength for open source and for standards. The idea being that if you follow more standards, then people can accept and understand what you're going to be doing and build tools that are more complicated, like things for
sight impaired people. Well, open source and standards are two different things. I mean, because we have worked with proprietary operating systems before and proprietary environments, but we still have always worked trying to make an open standard. In other words, we can decide to stop using one tool and move into using.
So what is the accessibility issue that these users had, and how does it fall under a situation where Target could lose this case? What actually was wrong with their website?
Well, frankly, their website was unusable by a blind person. You have images, an image... obviously something that's very visual. And there's a very easy way with websites to set up that where images have what's called alt text.
When you hover over an image, sometimes they'll show up a little word similar to that?
Internet Explorer will do that, but really that's the title tag to that.
Dee Dee, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Dee Dee, what state are you in?
I'm in Ohio.
Ohio. Okay, so you recently moved to, so you're an Ohio correspondent now. And it's hard to hear you, so if you can speak up, Dee Dee, that'd be great. But so, Miles, their site didn't have text that related to what the image was, and probably some other problems.
Well, it was also providing just general services having to do with the notifications about sales and things like that. That what happened was they were making things available for sighted customers that were not available for people who were visually impaired. And that is flying in the face of the Americans with Disabilities Act and other related statutes. And so that's where this is coming about. Now, folks have been sued before about this. And I actually remember a case a couple of years ago with Southwest Airlines. And that one was thrown out of court saying Southwest Airlines doesn't have to make it available, which I thought was odd. This one, however, the judge has come forward saying, no, we're not going to dismiss this case. This is going to trial, or at least moving forward. And saying that, yes, people, if they're going online is now a general service for any business. And it is subject to the same rules and regulations that a brick-and-mortar institution is.
Right. Well, I got to say, it's kind of exciting to me because there's always been this idea that if you do... The reason why I was trying to relate it to web standards is if you're doing web standards, if you're using web standards kind of take into account the idea that there'll be other types of things that read your pages, specifically, in this case, text readers.
Right. In order to have your page validate as a valid XHTML or HTML, these standards put forth by the World Wide Web Consortium, and these are free utilities that you can go out and do this with, then you are already a good 90% of the way toward accessibility.
Right.
Just right out of the box.
All right. Thank you very much, Miles, for that. I'm going to go to Dee Dee now. You got a news story for us, Dee Dee? In Ohio? I think you're moved.
It's not about Ohio.
Oh, okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
There's been a news release about a single pixel camera could simplify imaging. So I know that you're really big on photography, so I thought you might think this is interesting.
Mm-hmm. What does the single pixel do?
Yeah, this new camera, it uses mirrors to reflect the light onto a single pixel sensor instead of, you know, three or more, or, you know, a number of sensors in the camera. And so it just, instead of having the light hit three different sensors, it uses mirrors and takes a couple of shots in rapid succession, like within milliseconds of each other. And the main benefits are that it's a little bit more energy efficient and that you get smaller file sizes.
Okay, so we're not talking about a single pixel in the sense of an array, like it still has an array, but each pixel picks up all three colors of light, if you will.
No, one pixel.
One pixel. How do you get an image of one pixel?
I'm confused now.
Congratulations, Dee Dee. You've totally flabbergasted us. Okay, thank you.
I'm not going to... Like off of a single pixel, that reminds me of, yes, I'm going to read this book with a single photon of light over and over again.
Well, it's probably akin to scanning. And, I mean, it kind of makes sense.
It reflects light from 1024 by 768 micromirrors onto a single photodiode.
Yeah. I get this. Okay, so
I still don't.
Then it changes the arrangement of the micromirrors and repeats the process all in a split second.
I got it. So we got, Miles, is you've got all these mirrors for every pixel that you're actually going to produce, right? And one of them aims at that photon detector at one time, and it scans through and moves all those mirrors. So the photon's only getting, it's scanning across the entire array, but it's only one pickup sensor.
How do you move the mirrors one photon at a time?
You know, years ago...
Fast enough to make this work.
Years ago, I was offered a job at a company that did this kind of work and was on the chip. You actually have all the mirrors on the surface, and they have capacitances underneath them. And as you move the capacitance, the mirror moves.
Just
so as
hair.
You discharge and stuff. Yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff. And it was used for... What they were doing was using it for scattering sensors all over an area and then being able to detect them with a laser because they could be powered by that. But in any case, very cool technology, Dee Dee. It would be a lot less power consumption because you only have one thing that can actually have to detect light, which is actually kind of power consumption. So thank you very much for that.
No problem.
Okay, you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Trock, so we're going to get back to the news in just a minute, so stay tuned. I want to talk about the balanced coverage on KOSP and the thoughtful and rational, trustworthy and professional people that you hear every day on the station. Dedicated, honest, these are just some of the terms that people use to talk about the NPR program and the local program that you hear every day here on KOSP. Today we have uniquely human voices, people that you actually start to know, like Johnny Simmons in the morning and such, and you have you don't have that kind of sensationalism like action news, you know, at 6 o'clock, stay tuned, someone did something so drastic you can't miss it. There's not hype, there's not gimmicks, there's no sensationalism. We are dedicated professionals doing our best to entertain and enlighten you and educate you.
And if you've been waiting for the right time to make your contribution to KUSP, now is that time. Your contribution to KUSP right now, it will be a generous grant to us. We thank you very much for your time and effort. And it's all part of a community. It's us getting us providing this service and you listening and enjoying it with us. And therefore, please hurry. The opportunity to give your contribution, you know, you still have some time, but we want to have you give it to us right now, not later. So please call 888-777-1507 or make your contribution online now at our secure website, kusp.org.
Every day on KUSP, I hear features that are sound rich. They involve me. They suck me into the story. I feel like I'm right there with the reporter. And I only find this on public radio. I only find this on NPR and the other public content that we provide for you. You hear it when someone's out in a field. Someone's at a in more sensationalized news stories. Sometimes you hear a person on the street outside the courthouse reporting on like what the person was wearing. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about someone having discussion with a kid who's in school, and hearing the school around them and knowing that there's a reporter actually in there understanding what's happening for these children, and on the battlefield and. They're just all over the world. And when I'm in the car getting to work in the morning, that's when I listen to a lot of NPR news on KUSP. And when I get to work, it's so common for me to stay in my car. And these features are all brought to KUSP's listeners every day, 24/7. You get to explore the world just by listening to the radio.
And we have a matching grant from Mary Kay Gamble and Thomas Vogler for $500, which means that anything that you contribute right now to KUSP will be matched dollar for dollar. Up to $500. This opportunity will end soon, so please call soon. And if you, when you do pledge to KUSP, you can get up to for $120, you get the KUSP shirt. For just $10 a month, you can get that along with the ability to get both men's and women's styles with KUSP's signature artwork. And you can also choose the from the on-air CD or the two-for-one member card. Good for two-for-one meals at restaurants near you. So please call 1-888-777-1507. Or once again, go to kusp.org now and make your pledge.
I just want to say that in just another minute and a half, we're going to be getting back to the geek news. We're going to talk about some amazing stuff that's happened this week in technology, space, or we just talked about the Target accessibility issue, the lawsuit one recently. And we're about to go on with more news. We have tons for you. And we're here every week volunteering our time. Listeners of KUSP and of NPR listen to news reports longer than any other source of media. With KUSP and NPR newsmaking, You know the host, you listen to it all the time, you hear wonderful content like the Talk of the Bay segment that's every week. My wife does a segment on at the end on Friday of Talk of the Bay about theater. You learn something new every 30 seconds you listen to KUSP, be it music or our news and information shows. You're hearing and learning and being entertained in a new and enriching way that stimulates your mind. That's what we offer for you every day.
And there's that old saying, there's no time like the present. It's especially true during this membership campaign. We've got a few moments of time. Telephone is within easy reach. Your public radio station is asking for your support. Pick up the phone. Call 1-888-777-1507. That's 1-888-777-1507 now. And you can make this campaign a big success for KUSP and public radio. And thank you for your support.
All right, back to the news. Next news story, Miles, I'm going to actually... Well, Drew, would you like to cover a news story? You got something burning? Go for it.
We've got the most significant news site for marine reptiles to have been discovered in the last several decades.
And we're talking about site as in location that we found marine reptiles?
About an archaeological site that's 800 miles south of the North Pole in Norway. Pretty impressive. They found a total of 28 plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs, top marine predators at the time when dinosaurs were dominant on land. One of them was gigantic. This is the part I really like. Has vertebrae the size of dinner plates and teeth the size of cucumbers.
That's cool.
Scary.
I heard they had a nickname for that one.
The monster is what they call it. Yeah, that's not very creative. It must be a bunch of scientists that way, way out in the ice. What can we call this? The scariosaurus? Nah, the monster, yeah. All right, so the skull of the pliosaur, perhaps a distant relative to the, like, something they think it may have been shaped like the Loch Ness Monster, was among the biggest on record.
I like,
so how about that?
I like that you assess it to the side to what we think of this as this creature that is most likely imaginary, but very cool. Thank you very much, Drew.
I didn't. That's what the reporter.
I know.
Miles.
I know.
Here,
Miles.
MySpace. This thing has been in the news quite a few times. Think of it in terms of teenagers and college students always logging in and chatting all day. Well, it turns out that more than half of all MySpace users are now 35 years old or older.
Interesting. I thought it was a young environment.
Yeah, you would think so. Just a year ago, teens under 18 made up about 25% of MySpace, and now it's down to 12%. By contrast, the 35 to 54 group at MySpace grew to 41%
in August
from
32% a year ago. What kind of numbers are we talking about here? Because I've heard some crazy numbers in front of, about MySpace and how many people sign up all the time and how many people are involved. You got some numbers in front of you?
Do I know their methodology for finding this?
No,
I know.
How many people are playing?
Yeah,
are on MySpace?
Oh, I don't have it right here in front of me to be able to see. Sorry,
Didi,
we can scrub real quick here.
Didi, you're cool and hip. Do you know how many people are in MySpace?
I'm not that hip. I actually I'm not a big MySpace person. My friends keep sucking me in.
You know, Didi, that's the same experience I'm having. I've been thinking it's a bunch of 16-year-olds, what do I care? And a bunch of my friends are saying, when are you going to get a page?
Okay, here we go. Found it. ComScore has reported that MySpace has 56 million unique U.S. visitors in August.
Okay, those are visitors.
Right,
okay.
Which is much less than the 100 million-plus registered users MySpace has worldwide.
A third of the country is registered with MySpace?
Well, no, this is worldwide. MySpace is not
worldwide.
Just the U.S.
Okay.
So.
Additionally, these are accounts that exist, not necessarily active ones, and some people have multiple accounts. Bands have accounts.
That's true.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that got me about MySpace that I really, you know, understood, oh, this is major, is that I think the local paper Good Times covered a story about how the local venues in Santa Cruz, which book music, there's wonderful music in Santa Cruz happening all the time. Of course, you can hear it live at lunch every week, but on KOSP. But the people that book these venues, they use MySpace now to book. So they go up, they find the band page, they research them, they contact them, and they're basically doing it all through MySpace. So now you go to a venue like the Blue Lagoon, or is that the name of it?
Blue Lagoon Downtown. Yeah.
They actually have a MySpace page, and they link to the bands that they're going to have booked. It's very cool. I mean, it's a different way of using the technology, but I kind of like the idea. The thing that irks me about MySpace all the time is that it's owned by Rupert Murdoch. It's not this free, evolving community. It's a corporate
There's beast. Actually some hubbub about that. There's a former, or no, I shouldn't say former, a co-founder of MySpace has said that deal was kind of shady.
Yeah, I bet.
I mean, to the point that...
He didn't just say shady. He said it defrauded their shareholders.
Okay, yes.
That's pretty strong.
Where the purchase price of MySpace by News Corp, he's alleging, was about 1% of what it should have been. Like it was off by two orders of magnitude of what it should have been.
Wow.
When he was comparing it to other similar items that someone else, that his partner had sold it without fully consulting everyone. And
interesting. So it was kind of a shady sale, not necessarily purchase.
Well, this is just coming out. This is the last week, so I don't know that many details about it. Didi, do you know more about this?
It just came up on TechDirt a while ago, especially when you consider that there are the rumors floating around that Google might be buying YouTube for $1.6 billion.
I like
that's
that.
A big number.
That's amazing. A company that
and
makes
then when
no
you
money.
Look at when you look at MySpace at like $500 million, it seems like a bargain.
Yeah. Well, and MySpace doesn't cost as much to run as YouTube, I don't think. I mean, YouTube is just an insane amount of money being poured out every week for that bandwidth. Okay. There's so much to cover. I want to talk about everything. I mean, like, you bring up YouTube, and Drew, it's a perfect example. They're not making any money. They're burning through cash, but they're not making any money. There's no revenue for that site. But at the same time, they're redefining how entertainment works. I mean, right now, there's so much content being watched on YouTube that isn't created by some large umbrella corporation like Disney or something. It's created by individuals making content, and it's interesting and funny and sometimes horrible. horrible, but it's changing.
So does MySpace make money?
Is it like MySpace makes a lot of money. Ads and, yeah, I think ads, and I think you can have
all those ringtone ads that are up there. That,
oh my God, at least horrible. They have ads. I mean, YouTube doesn't. All right.
They're a record company now, too.
They're producing bands.
Oh, okay.
That's right. Great. Okay, so basically, Drew, I mean, Miles, this was all headed off by the idea that the MySpace population average is increasing, and that's up to 35.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
It's much older than everyone was expecting.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. All right, next news story. And Miles, since you have so many up here, I'm going to go to you.
Okay. The next step in teleportation is upon us.
Oh, yeah, I read that article. It's so cool.
So, a couple of years ago, folks were able to use what's known as quantum entanglement, entangling two atoms to behave the same way. To teleport a single atom, basically half a millimeter. It wasn't that far, but as far as like atomic scales are concerned, it was a huge distance. However, what has just been done is a group of Danish researchers have actually teleported thousands of billions of atoms or trillions of atoms, which are still on a microscopic scale, but have transported this clump of atoms a distance of half a meter.
Now, so an actual piece of matter, like as in millions and billions of atoms.
No, trillions.
Trillions of atoms.
Thousands of billions is how they meant.
Picked up and moved?
Well, not picked up.
Teleported.
Well, from one place to another.
Yes.
It was here now, and now it's not, and now it's over here.
Yes, a meter away. Yeah. Yeah.
And there was no wires, no hands, no...
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of wires.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
But you know lasers, what I mean. Nothing and touching the stuff?
Lasers and quantum entanglement.
Yeah.
What was it that they moved again?
Some matter.
What does that mean? I mean, is that like gelatinous goo? What is it?
Well, yeah, it's just a bunch of atoms. So, I mean, it's not...
It had to be shaped in something. Come on, I'm a
real
life guy.
Well, no, it doesn't really have to be.
Did they take it out of the tabletop? Did they take it out of...
Oh, no, no. It was the sample that they used.
What was the sample?
I don't know what material it was.
Was it a rabbit and a hat?
No. I think of it as a nondescript collection of atoms that was perfectly duplicated in a different location.
I live in the real world, not the theoretical.
You can't live in the real world with this stuff yet, I don't think.
Did they just detect it?
No, they moved it. They teleported it.
They teleported it half a meter.
Let me put it this way.
Scale underneath it.
Are we going to have Schrodinger's cat problems now?
Kind of. Trillions of atoms were sitting in a location. They were probably all the same type of atom.
Right.
And they all had exactly a certain amount of quantum signature of each of those. Those quantum signatures that define those atoms were put in a new location at a meter away. Teleportation.
So if there were a scale under the first banana and they took the banana atoms and moved them across, would there have been a difference?
If it was a banana. You decide every day how much to contribute to KOSP. Wait, I'm sorry, Miles, you're supposed to start this. First off, let me start this way by saying that we're about to talk with this amazing guy that's a linguist and this mathematician historian. His name is John Derbyshire, and he's an author of Prime Obsession in the book that I've currently been reading, Unknown Quantity, A Real and Imaginary History of Algebra. We'll be talking with him in just a few minutes.
But as far as KOSP is concerned, what we're working on is you're listening to Geek Speak, and the entire community of KOSP actually began in 1972. Can you believe that? This is a while ago, and I'm afraid to mention like how far that is as far as I'm concerned in terms of age. But this is community radio. We are volunteers. Some of the volunteers have actually been here since the beginning, since 1972. And now we have over 100 volunteer hosts, including Lyle, Drew, myself, and Dee Dee doing Geek Speak. We'd like to be responsive to the needs of the community. We'd like to be responsive to your needs, to entertain you, to educate you. And listener contributions make up over 50% of our revenue. So we are talking about real people, real communities, 24/7. For over 30 years.
And you decide how much to contribute to KOSP. For a gift of 50 or more, you can receive the U.S. Constitution and Fascinating Facts book. The Constitution, of course, is the background to so many events that are happening that you hear here on KOSP all the time. Why not have it in your hands? This mini reference guide, it's about the foundation of the nation's foundation. And it's most importantly, of course, your $50 contribution helps to pay for the news and the information and the music you rely on at KOSP. Pledge $50 now and receive a U.S. Constitution and a Fascinating Facts book. Call 1-888-777-1507. That's 888 877-1507 or make a web pledge at kosp.org.
And there's a difference when you tune in to public radio. You listen to public radio because you like to stay informed, because KUSP is a unique source of information and entertainment. We take the time to provide in-depth look at issues, to tell a story, to put a human face on it, and to sound in a compelling way. We're not driven by a rating system. We're driven by the content. It's because we're supported by listeners like you. Only with your support are we able to provide this unique news service that you've come to rely on. So call us now or make a web pledge online at our secure website.
You can phone in your contribution to KSP. The phone number is 1-888-777-1507. That's 888-777-1507. Or you can make your contribution to KOSP online at our secure website, kosp.org. In addition to being secure and very geeky, pledging online at our new website is easy. The process is straightforward. The screens are easy to read. It's a breeze. And it only takes a few minutes. We try to keep the number of required fields to a minimum, so you're not going to be entering your cat's name. You know, you're going to be just entering the information we need. And if you're near a computer, that's really the way to go. I mean, I do it. I'm near a computer all the time, of course. I have to be. Go ahead and make the pledge online. We appreciate your contribution and support of public radio. KOSP.org.
And KOSP is all about, you know, for example, personal improvement, lifelong learning. We learn more by listening to KOSP. At least I hope people are learning from GeekSpeak.
I don't know if they're learning
from us. Regardless, and it doesn't matter about, you know, how much education you have. It's about your interest in getting involved. It's based upon your curiosity level. We're satisfying a need for lifelong learning. We're offering more in-depth information than many other sources. We're trying to present that information in a more engaging way. And your contribution helps secure our ability to provide that learning. Our commitment to you each and every day, every day of the year. For GeekSpeak, it's once a week. But KOSP is every day of the year.
KOSP is here all the time, even though we're here only weekly. With a gift of $500 or more, you can be invited to special dinners of KOSP. What we do is we take some people that have donated a lot of money to KOSP, and we invite them to participate in our family community by inviting them to dinners. We do we go to dinners at the Bittersweet Bistro in Aptos, November 2nd, Strokes Restaurant in Monterey, November 8th. And you can also get a CD of music that we play, KOSP's new On the Air music CD, which we've produced from the local music shows you hear. You'll be supporting a radio station at a completely new level. You'll be involved at a completely new level with a gift of $500. Check online for the thank you gifts and to make a pledge, kosp.org, or call 888-777-1507. That's 1-888-777-1507. And the other way to talk about this is the number that we're about to go into the segment, this great segment, so please stay with us, with John Derbyshire about math. And so this number is 8,887,771,507. That's the phone number, 888-777-1507.
You are such a geek, Lyle.
I am, aren't I?
Yeah, that was proof, wasn't it?
GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online with businesswithpleasure.com.
Listen to the unique voices of our community on First Person Singular, bringing you local artists and poets, novelists, students and teachers, community activists and retirees with their stories and anecdotes on a wide range of topics. That's First Person Singular every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7:33 a.m. and 5:33 p.m. and on Sunday afternoon at 4:58 p.m., just before Weekend All Things Considered, only on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
You're listening to KUSP, where we are about to talk with John Derbyshire and the geeks this morning, Miles Elam, Dee Dee Hubbard. We're going to have to say goodbye to you, Dee Dee. I really appreciate you calling in with news and everything, but thank you, but we're going to have to say goodbye now. Dee Dee?
See you later.
See you later. Take care. And did I say Miles or Drew already? Miles Elam and Drew Meyer. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruise.io has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruise.io.com. or by calling 459-6301. All right. John Derbyshire is a mathematician and linguist and is the author of crime obsession and his current book, Unknown Quantity, A Real and Imaginary History of Algebra. John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, thank you, Lal. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I've been enjoying your book for the last 2 weeks. One thing that happened to me recently with this book, I have little kids, and I always had a bookmark in it, and I had it laying around my house, which if you have little kids, is a bad thing to do. So later on in the day, I find the book again. My bookmark's been pulled out, okay? And the cover is gone, and there's crayon marks inside. It's a very loved book already in my house.
Good.
So I'm like, okay, this shouldn't be a problem. I'll just flip through and find where I was reading. So I start flipping through, and I'm catched by all these algorithms and math problems and all this code that's in it, right? I'm like, I haven't gotten this far. And I keep on moving back up and backing up and backing up and realizing, no. When I finally find my space, sure enough, I'm already past all these equations and everything that are in the book, and I realized that I didn't even notice that the equations happened because you're describing them so well. I wasn't uncomfortable with them. So that was kind of an enlightening experience for me.
That's very flattering. Thank you.
Well, certainly.
That's the effect I hope to attain.
Let's talk a little. Well, first off, the unknown quantity is kind of the definition in some ways of algebra. Can you give me what your feel is the definition of algebra?
It's hard to define.
Yeah.
I hope I show in the book that the unknown quantity, the X, you know, you say algebra, people think of X, you know, find X.
Right.
Solve for X. That unknown quantity, that was algebra up to the 19th century, up to about 1820. If you'd ask the mathematician what is algebra, he would say, well, it's solving equations, finding the unknown quantity. After that, algebra took off in a number of different directions, and I try to show why that happened and what some of those directions were. The way I express it is it ascended to higher levels of abstraction, so that
the X's domain got a little larger, kind of. You got more confusion about what the unknown
well,
was.
Yes, they stayed pretty much the same size on the printed page, but they started to refer to things other than numbers.
Ah, okay.
You say that's mathematics is about what I call mathematical objects, defined circularly to be the things that mathematicians think about. And numbers are just the most familiar kind of mathematical object.
Okay.
Another kind of mathematical object would be a line or a point or a triangle, you know, in classical geometry. Those
right.
are mathematical objects. Those are things that mathematicians write theorems about. And in the 19th century, the number of mathematical objects blossomed.
Ah, okay, I got it. Okay, well, let's talk about the early history, because the first half of the book, well, the whole book really is about a history of algebra, but the beginning of this book is so wonderful in that it kind of places how large this problem is. We've been thinking about math for thousands and thousands of years, and for a long time we didn't get very far. And so maybe in the 19th century we have this huge blossoming of what we consider math domains or math objects. But early on it moved really slow. Can you tell me a little bit about Babylon? Because we normally talk about early math coming from Babylon. What do we got in Babylon in cuneiform text? Can you tell me about cuneiform?
We have as I say in the book, we have basically two kinds of cuneiform tablets dealing with math. We have table texts where you have these. It's like I don't know if they still have them in schools, but when I was in school, when you got into advanced math, they gave you a book of mathematical tables. There were logs, there were sines, there were cosines, you know, squares and cubes, and one family of these cuneiform tablets is tables like that. Of course, they didn't have sines and cosines, but they had squares and cubes and various other
things. And they're basically someone going through the process of figuring it out the first time and then writing it down the table. We're familiar with this for children learning their times tables. That's an example
right.
of it, right?
So you've got just so you don't have to figure it out anew every time.
Right.
You know, what is 7 times 6? Well, if you had to figure it out on your fingers every time, you'd waste an awful lot of time. So it's better just to commit it to memory or to a tablet.
And so that tablet form has existed for eons in the cuneiform field. What era was this? What era did the cuneiform start first happening? And I'm asking dates and numbers.
Cuneiform itself took off in by the end of the 4th millennium B.C., about 3,000 and something B.C. But the mathematical texts, the ones that mathematicians get excited about, mostly date from about 500 years later than that, from about 1800 or 1700.
And what was different about those? What were they? I mean, I'm sorry, the math problems in cuneiform, what did they describe?
Yeah, as I said, there are two families of text. One is these tables, and the other one is problem tablets, where mathematical problems are worked out. And they're worked out in a way that you can fairly call algebraic, because in a lot of them, the problem is saying, what's the number that satisfies these conditions? What's the unknown quantity? So they are kind of algebraic, and
but
that's
word
usually marked as the beginning of algebra.
But they're word problems.
They're word problems, yeah. And they stayed word problems, really, with the exception of Diophantus, they mostly stayed word problems down to about 1600 AD, down to the time of Descartes.
John, you've been studying this for a while. I want to get this cuneiform just a second. Why would somebody take the time to write down this word problem in clay? I mean, it seems like a very arduous process to write down one example of a problem. I mean, why was it that they did this? Were they able to use this word problem as an abstraction to solve more problems, or was it just a one-case solution?
That's a very interesting question, and we actually don't know the answer. We don't know why they did it. As I say in my book, there are two great mysteries about the Babylonian math. One, why they went to so much trouble, and two, the names of the people who did it. We don't really know either. We don't know the names of any Babylonian mathematicians. They didn't sign their tablets, unfortunately. And we don't really know why they did it, although we have some inspired guesses. In my book, I offer the guess that they did it as a way of reverse engineering the kinds of calculations that any civilization had to do. You know, you want to dig a ditch so deep and so long and so wide, how much earth are you going to have to move? Things like that, or you want to mark off a field after a flood. These sorts of things they had to do, but that's basic arithmetic. It becomes algebra if you try to work them backwards. And I suggest that possibly they were just using these algebraic methods as a check on their arithmetic.
Okay, so they do their arithmetic.
But there are other opinions about it.
Okay.
Some scholars think they were just showing off. It was just a purely abstract mathematical
look
game.
What I can do, yeah.
Yeah, really.
You mentioned...
I mean, people do that.
So that is 3000 BC. So then you just mentioned Diophantus. Diophantus, is that his name?
Diophantus.
Diophantus. And of course, we don't know much about him. He existed in 100, 200, 300, one of those centuries
the
current era.
Probably the century, AD,
and he's basically conceptualized as the father of algebra, though that, of course, is also up to debate. And we don't really know much about where he came from, if he was just copying stuff or whatever. But you mentioned something about it that really got me, was that he used negative numbers, but couldn't accept that negative numbers were a good thing to think about. So it was like this weird dichotomy that exists. And I think that a lot of people go through school and kind of get this idea that you're taught when you have 2 and you subtract 7, you've got a negative 5, and that's some kind of weird thing. Miles had this great metaphor to explain negative numbers. What is it, Miles? The sand.
Well, you go out to the beach, you have a little shovel, and you dig a hole. The hole that's left over, that's a negative number. The amount of dirt that you've taken out and made a mound out of, that's a positive number.
So why was Diophantus, I'm butchering his name.
Diophantus.
Diophantus.
Yes.
Why was Diophantus so difficult? Why did he dislike the idea of negative number?
Well, you have to try to project your thinking back into the way they thought. Negative numbers, it's actually a very difficult idea, and it struggled to be born across many centuries. And there were intermediate ways of thinking about it. Diophantus didn't know about negative numbers, and yet he managed to use them as intermediates in his calculations, as intermediate steps, as if, like what in chemistry is called a catalyst. You know, you bring a substance in to help a reaction along, and at the end you just take out the substance again. And there were intermediate stages like this in understanding negative numbers before people started to think of them as objects in their own right. People didn't really think of negative numbers as objects in their own right until the Renaissance. You get an argument here from some people with the Indian mathematicians, but I think until the Renaissance, -7 as a number, as a thing, as a mathematical object in its own right, that couldn't really be thought of until centuries of internalizing these
amazing,
vague intermediate ideas had passed.
You're listening to KUSP. This is Geek Speak. We're talking with John Derbyshire. He's the author of The Unknown Quantity, A Real and Imaginary History of Algebra. And I got to say that I am personally very proud to have John on the show. I've been enjoying his book. I enjoy the concepts of thinking about how our society as a whole conceptualizes knowledge and how it grows. And GeekSpeak addresses this all the time with this rapid succession of technology. We do this all the time. And I'm proud to be a part of the station and to do my job every week helping you to understand the world about us in the sense of this technical space that we embrace so well as geeks. We do this with care, with balance, and with thoughtfulness, just like the rest of the stuff you hear on KOSP. It's not true with other media sources all the time, but it's definitely true here, and your contributions make thoughtful knowledge or thoughtful discussion possible.
And once again, we have a matching pledge waiting for us from Mary Kay Gamble and Thomas Vogler for a total of $500. So during the hour of Geek Speak, you will be matching your pledge dollar for dollar up to $500 if you call in now. We rely on your support, and at the $80 level, you're going to be getting the new on-the-air CD, 15 Superb Live Performances, captured exclusively for KUSP, plus our two-for-one member card, discounts at Central Coast restaurants, and it is our most popular gift level for new members. That's $80. It's the $80 level. And remember, 50% of our revenue comes from listener contributions. So please help us reach the goal we've been working on right now. Call 1-888-777-1507.
Thank you for listening to KSP. You listen to KSP as a lifetime of education. You listen because it engages and stimulates and makes you think in new ways. Every day you receive lessons in civics, science, culture, with access to the best minds in the country, like our guest, John Derbyshire, about mathematics today, but about everything every day you hear it on KOSP. You receive an engaged and informative discussion and debate about the world around you. This is a value. This is independent news service. A lot of people who listen to KOSP believe that public radio is essential to democracy. Please take this opportunity to help keep this news service, this cultural service, free and strong. Please call now. Become a financial supporter right now. Call us. Make a pledge. Your decision.
Yeah, and our era goes by fast. Everything goes by fast. All this information goes by very fast, very quick. And your pledge into the station can come just as quickly. You'll be off the phone in just a moment. You'll feel good about supporting public radio and KUSP. Just call 1-888-777-1507. That's 1-888-777-1507. Or make a quick pledge online on our new secure website, kusp.org. And thank you.
John, thank you for sitting through that with us. It's very important to keep this station going strong. John,
I know all about it. Yep.
Yeah. Are you a NPR listener? Are you a public radio station listener?
Yes, I am. And by default, my wife is a great NPR listener, and she usually has NPR on as background, and I just started listening on that basis.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an easy thing to get sucked into because it's so engaging, you know, and it makes you feel like you're a part of this wonderful. Well, anyway, let's talk about math. Okay, so something hit me, and if you got a book in front of you, it's page 162 or 161, which is what started me out on this. And it's this idea that about 2,000 years ago, a book was written, who knows who from and all that, called Nine Chapters on the Art of Calculation. And it's kind of the first programming book in the sense that, I mean, it relates to me because I'm a programmer, this idea that you can write down these rules to follow. And once somebody's figured out the rules, then you're good to go with them. Can you tell me a little bit about what's in this book, Nine Chapters on the Art of Calculation, and who wrote it?
Yes. We don't actually know who wrote it. It's a compilation, and the oldest version we have is from the first century B.C., so that is later than the great burning of the books, which happened in 215 BC, I think.
And the Library of Alexandria, if we're talking about?
No. That was burned much later. And well, in fact, it was burned three times. But before 215 BC, China was a loose collection of little statelets. It was rather like medieval Europe with a France and a Germany and Italy, except they all spoke more or less the same language. It was unified into a really unitary single state by an emperor who came along in the last years of the 3rd century BC. He unified the empire by brute force, and one of the aspects of that force was that he ordered the destruction of all books of philosophy and statecraft that existed at that time.
In China?
In China, yeah. And he also executed a lot of the scholars. Whether this book survived through that book burning, we don't know. As I said, the earliest tradition we have is from many decades after that. But it's possible that that whatever math books existed before that point were burned. But fortunately, that emperor was very short-lived, and after he'd gone and things settled down again, scholars came out of hiding, and they had memorized a lot of these old books, and so they wrote them down. They wrote down what they'd memorized.
This is the
and
theory.
A lot of ancient Chinese books come to us in that form as compilations of earlier books that had been destroyed in the Great Burning.
So what are they doing? What are they doing in this book that is so unique and interesting to algebra?
The most interesting thing they do, which is the one that I describe in that chapter, is they solve simultaneous equations. I don't know if you remember from high school math doing simultaneous equations where you have usually in high school it's two variables, an X and a Y, and you have two equations in the X and the Y, and you have to solve for X and for Y. You have two unknowns, in other words.
Right. In the U.S., we always refer to it as solving a system of two equations, yeah.
Okay, good. Nine Chapters on the Mathematical Art has an example of actually solving three simultaneous equations. In other words, there's an X, a Y, and a Z. Although they don't have, obviously they don't have X's, Y's, and Z's, but it's equivalent to that. Again, it's a word problem. It's set out as a word problem. And that's quite advanced. And the technique that the unknown author of that text uses to solve that system of three equations is actually quite a modern technique. It's we know it, but we've attached the name of Gauss to it, the great 18th-19th century German mathematician. It's that modern.
Well, we've been talking about this in terms of conceptuals. I'm wondering if you can give an example of something more concrete. Like, what's an example in the real world where we use a system of two equations to find the puzzle?
Anywhere where you have more than one unknown. The example that is used in that Chinese text involves three different kinds of grain, and obviously these three different kinds of grain have different densities, so they weigh different amounts, and you have so many baskets of the first type and so many baskets of the second type and so many baskets of the third type all together weigh such and such. And then you vary the number of baskets, and that comes out to a different weight. And then you vary the number of baskets again, and that comes out to a different weight. Can you say how much one basket of each type of grain weighs? That sort of thing.
And by doing this, you're optimizing how many baskets you can have and how many people you can feed. And
You could proceed to that, yes. Yeah.
Now, this touches upon something. This kind of got me thinking about something. I think people in this country, maybe it's universal, have a difficulty in accepting math as a tool that they use all the time. They don't necessarily feel like math is, you know, in their belt. And this abstraction, I think, is one of those things that makes it so frustrating. I think geeks do a little bit more of this abstraction for fun, and it's something that happens all the time. But people don't necessarily see this as something they run into all the time. Can you address the human condition of math a bit?
Yeah, I don't think, I've never thought that math was very human. What human beings are mostly interested in is other human beings. We're very much a social animal, you know. And it's very difficult for most people to withdraw. I think of it as withdrawing to the level of abstraction you need to think about these pure mathematical objects, because they're so impersonal. Bertrand Russell said something like, mathematics is extremely beautiful, but it's a cold, it's an icy cold kind of beauty. There's nothing human about it. And I think that repels a lot of people. I think he was right, and I think that's the repulsive aspect of mathematics. But the beauty, of course, is the attractive aspect.
Yeah, yeah. What do you find so beautiful about math? What motivates you to spend your entire life in some way studying the history and math itself?
Well, I better make it clear that, in fact, I don't. I'm not a working mathematician. I'm a writer with a math degree. What do I find beautiful? It's very hard to say. I fell in love with math quite early in life. I wasn't actually much good at it. I went to a good English university and did a degree in math. But what very often happens when you go from being the star of your high school, you go to a good university and you're just an average student. A big fish in a big pool now. And I found a lot of people were much better at it than I was. So I decided not to spend my life doing math. I went and did other things. But I've always kept the old affection, and I've always subscribed to math magazines. I subscribe to 5 math magazines at the moment. And it's like, I think of it as a sort of unrequited love. You know, I love mathematics, but it doesn't love me back.
Despite the fact that you have a degree in it, which is far more than the rest of us in this room.
But the math muse didn't kiss me at any point.
Yeah. Well, let me say that your passion for math and your interest in it got me very interested in math again by reading your book. And it really, from the perspective of telling the human story of how difficult it has been to us to get to this amazing point we are with math. And of course, I'm talking before computers helped us even more. We have grown in the last century in math in amazing ways. And I think to a large degree, of course, it's technology, books, for example, and even new languages being produced, the symbology of math that's driven that drive. And seeing that in a context of history has been very helpful to me. So thank you, John Derbyshire, for your wonderful book. And I appreciate you being on GeekSpeak today to share it with us.
Thank you, Lyle. It was a pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
The book is Unknown Quantity, Real and Imaginary History of Algebra by John Derbyshire, author of Prime Obsession. It's available by Joseph Henry Press. And I really appreciate John coming on GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak every week, of course, is here to support your need and drive for understanding more about technology. Normally, we take your calls with questions and comments of technology to help you through the problems and also to help share the problems that all of us have, the frustration we have with technology. And let me just say, even though I'm a geek and I embrace computers and technology all the time, I share it with you. Without the knowledge that I can find of other people going through the same experiences as me, I would be as frustrated and fed up with technology as anybody. But that's why I do GeekSpeak. That's why I'm here every week, because I know that I have some knowledge of specific areas in technology. And if I share that with you, with everybody I know to some degree, I get the satisfaction of making that experience less uncomfortable for people. And that's one of the reasons why I asked John to be on the show to talk about math, because that's one of those things that all of us get. Math's complicated. Technology is very complicated. We're here every week on GeekSpeak to help you out. KOSP is here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year, to help you out with a lot of things that makes you a human being. The news, knowledge, information that we are, that we produce on GeekSpeak and on other talk shows, and of course NPR News, but also the wonderful music that enriches your soul can be heard here all the time on KOSP.